Hello and welcome again to Catholic Answers Focus. I am Cy Kellett, your host. And today we meet the Iraqi Christian diaspora. Dalal Saeed is our guest, now 23 years old. She was born in Iraq and became a refugee at the age of 8. She fled Iraq to Syria, seeking, as she says, the promised land, and went through a whole variety of ups and downs to finally make it to the United States. 7 years ago, Dalal is currently studying kinesiology with the dream of becoming a doctor of physical therapy. Her journey begins amidst, I think it's the American occupation. Is that right, Dalal?
Yeah, right now it's very growing.
Yeah.
It's very popular.
So what was that, about 2002 when you left? I'm trying to just do the math. When you were 7 or 8?
Yeah, it was right when the events started happening. And of course, okay. Things started happening a long time ago before the actual official war. So there were things happening when we were there, and we left, right when it happened.
When you say we left, who left?
It was both of my parents and my three brothers and me. But my sister was married, and she had to stay over there. Unfortunately, we had to leave her behind with her husband and her children, and we left her in Iraq, and we left to Syria.
And so what part of Iraq were you born in, and did your family live in?
We were in the main, Baghdad, the main city.
Oh, really? Okay. Mm. So now I suppose I had an image of Christians in Iraq being mostly up in the Nineveh area. Is that true or am I off?
Oh, that is very true. A lot of Chaldeans and a lot of the Christians come from northern Iraq, and that's where my mom is from. But they had her family and my dad's family, had to go to the main city for one reason or another. I don't know the details, but they did move from, northern Iraq to go to the main city and maybe for jobs or a better place or something like that.
So in Baghdad, there at the time would have been Catholic parishes, Catholic schools, all that?
I mean, there are a couple of churches around, but they're not as obvious as others, in other countries and stuff like that. There are very, very few Catholic schools, but they were, hidden. They're not as easy to see or locate.
I see. And now, if you leave at 8, how crisp and clear are your memories of Iraq?
Not very clear, but I've actually learned a lot of things after we moved on, I came here. And every time, I have a conversation with my parents and I ask them about things and they explain things for me.
Yeah.
And because I was, I'm just starting to open up and see what is actually going on there right now. And they tell me something new every time I talk to them, and I learn something new from them every time I talk to them. And just by keeping up with the news, keeping up with people that we know over there and stuff like that. And I just keep finding out things, but I don't personally have a very clear image of Iraq. I do have a clearer picture of Syria because that's where I lived my teen years.
It comes into focus there when you go to Syria.
A little more.
Have your parents shared with you what life for them was like under the Ba'athist Party and Saddam Hussein?
They said it was very brutal. It was very hard. You basically, had no choice with what to do or, with your life. It was very, very emotional, I should say, because they didn't have a lot of control.
Uh-huh. And, but they could live and practice as Christians.
In Iraq?
In Iraq, yeah.
Technically you could, but speaking of Iraq as a country, it's mainly dominated by Muslims.
Yeah.
So it's considered to be a Muslim country, even though it's not, specified or anything like that. But if you live in a country where most people are Muslims, then if you're not from them, they're going to give you some options. You can be a Muslim, you can convert, basically, or you can just stay and die because we're not going to let you stay here unless you're one of us.
Yeah. And your parents must have gone through a great deal of war, the war with Iran, then the American invasion, the first American invasion after the invasion of Kuwait, and what we call now the first Gulf War. And then they were looking at another Gulf War coming at that time. So what precipitated them leaving? What was the precipitating, we've got to go now?
You know, my dad went through, he was a soldier. He was forced to go into the military for a couple of years. And, you know, they went through that. They went through poverty and everything was good. Not good, but everything was okay. But then once my parents had, you know, my sister, my brothers, and then they looked at me, and my dad just looked at us growing, and he said, I have a girl growing up, and if we stay here, this girl is going to be kidnapped, it's going to be raped, it's going to be, everything's going to happen to this girl.
Under Saddam Hussein's reign.
And then this, you know, these guys, the three boys I have, are going to be forced to carry guns at the age of 11, 12, even younger.
Yeah.
And so he didn't want that to happen because he had, you know, a taste of it when he went to the military. And he said, I'm not going to let this happen to my children. And I want to change it.
So how do you get to Syria then? How do you get from Baghdad to Syria?
Oh, we would like to say it's easy, but it's actually not. It's very, very hard. You know, they tell you to leave, but then this is a different group than the group, than the groups that are actually, you know, placed on the way.
Yeah.
And every time you travel a little bit, you know, they're going to ask you for money to pass this, you know, checkpoint. And, you know, the driver who was taking us, actually, he used to, you know, take some of the money that we used to give. And, you know, whatever money we had, we spent it all just trying to get out of there. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, halfway through, we thought, you know, we're going to go back because we can't pass this checkpoint. And, you know, by the grace of God, we were able to make it.
Do you remember the journey?
I do remember a little bit of it. I remember it very, you know, dark, and, you know, it was at night, and it was very emotional because I remember when we passed the entire, you know, checkpoints and we made it to Syria, and I was looking into the distance, and I just saw some lights very, very far, and I said, oh, this is where I was right now. I mean, technically, it wasn't, but I just looked into the distance and I saw lights and I said, oh my gosh, this is where I was. And then I looked in the other side and I said, oh my God, this is where I'm going.
Yeah.
And it was just like, what's going on? You know, it felt scary. It felt good. It felt mixed emotions.
Really, being a refugee and crossing the desert and at night brings out mixed emotions in a child.
Yeah, I would say so.
I'm shocked to hear that, Dalal. So, okay, so Syria, though, is the Assad's rule Syria. It's also a Ba'athist country. But your parents had a sense that it would be better for your family there?
You know, there was an incident that happened in Iraq, which actually triggered the whole thing of us leaving at that specific, you know, time.
Yeah.
But then when we got to Syria, it was no option. It was no option that, oh, we want to go to Jordan. We want to go to Syria. It was just like, what is the closest place that we can go right now that we can survive in without being killed? You know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't. It wasn't like a 100% choice. Because if it was, you know, a choice, we would choose to come here, you know, instead of going to Syria. Because one thing people may not, you know that when you do go to these countries, the neighboring countries, you don't get a long time stay. You only get a 3 month visa. That's all you get.
I see.
And so it wasn't like my parents knew that was happening, that was coming up, but that was even better than whatever was going to happen to us if we stay.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't really a choice. So we just went to Syria and, you know, luckily it was a little better. You know, churches are more placed, you know, where you can see them, and we were able to go to church. And
Now you were, the church that you were raised in was the Chaldean Catholic Church, is that right?
My mother is Catholic, Chaldean.
And your father?
And my dad is Syriac.
Ah, okay. Mm-hmm. So they're very, very similar.
Mm-hmm.
But one at the time was in full communion with the Roman Catholic Church, mm-hmm. and the other was not. Is that correct? Or am I thinking of the Assyrian Church?
I really don't. I think you are thinking of the Assyrian, but I'm not, you know, sure about the differences between them.
Right.
I, you know, personally just identify as Catholic and my family. So, and these are just different groups in the Middle East.
Fair enough. And so you're in Syria, you're able to go to a Catholic church. You're able to find that.
Mm-hmm.
And where were you in Syria?
We first started in the city called Hama, but then we moved to Aleppo. because of, you know, better jobs. Because Hama was more like a village.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like a main city. Uh-huh. And, you know, knowing that we need money, so we had to go to a city where we can find jobs and stuff like that.
So how long were you personally in Aleppo?
Approximately another 8 years.
Okay, so you go through your childhood, the rest of your childhood into your adolescent years in Aleppo.
Mm-hmm.
And you feel safe there, or you don't feel safe there?
It was safer.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't 100% safe, but it was safer.
And your family wanted to go where?
My family originally wanted to come here.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of my uncles is here.
In San Diego.
In San Diego.
And many Chaldeans, Catholics have settled in San Diego and in Michigan.
Michigan.
So those it's common to go to those places. Mm-hmm. Okay, so, but you're there in Syria and you're raised in Syria. And this was before the war came to Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was much more peaceful than it is now.
It was.
And do you... I will try to ask this delicately, but Aleppo has since suffered terribly in the war. And you know many people. Have you been in contact with people in Aleppo?
Yes. I'm still in contact with a lot of my friends and a lot of the priests, actually, that I went to church over there. And to be honest, you know, not because I'm heartless or anything towards Iraq, but because I don't remember Iraq, but I lived years with those people in Syria, and seeing all of that happen is a little more emotional for me.
Yes.
Right. It's a little more, like, hits the spot for me.
Right, right. And so can you tell us anything about the conditions of Christians living in Syria now?
From what I've heard from people I have over there, it is horrible. You can't, you know, you can't just simply leave the house. You can't, you know, you can't go to church because it's not safe. You know, you're in your house, you're not safe. Nothing is safe. And of course, it's a war. But it's very, how can I say this? It's very Iraq-like now. You know, kind of like because when we first went to Syria, like, you know, some people weren't very friendly to us in Syria and telling us to leave. But now it's kind of like the wheel turned over, and now, you know, the Syrian people are facing the same thing we were facing.
They have to go to Jordan, or they have to go to Turkey.
Oh, yeah, a lot of Syrians left to the neighboring country.
Right. And do you have friends that are there in Jordan, for example?
No, not in other neighboring countries, but I have friends in Syria. They're still in.
Uh-huh. And so now you live in your family lives in San Diego. Mm-hmm. You go to school in Los Angeles.
Yes, I do.
And what's it like? For the people who live here, are they just generally still in contact with friends and family? Is there still lots of anguish about getting family members out and over here? Or what's the kind of, I guess, the emotional state of Chaldean Catholics and Syriac Catholics here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's the case with a lot of people when they, you know, when we were here, we're worrying about the people who we have relatives and over there. And, you know, personally, I don't have any relatives back home anymore, but these people, my friends, the priests I went to their churches, these are my family now, and I ache for them. And I worry about any Christian in the Middle East that's having to face terror right now, because I have a heart for everybody who's being, you know, forced or not being, you know, not having a safe place, you know, not only Christians, just anybody who's not in a safe place and where they need to be right now. And so I think that's the case with a lot of people, is they want to get whoever they know, however way possible, just get them out of there and then, you know, not worry about what's going to come next, because everything will fall into place.
And we lost track of your sister, though. You left her in Baghdad, and now you said everyone in your family...
My sister's okay, don't worry.
Okay, so she's here?
No, she's not, actually. She was... Actually, so when we went to Syria, a couple of years later, she actually followed us to Syria.
Okay.
So we were living, like, house next to house in Syria.
Uh-huh.
And a couple of years later, her papers came in, her family's papers came in, so she actually ended up going to Australia before us. And so she left to Australia...
Oh, so she got to leave you behind then?
Yes, she left us behind. It's like,
right.
Well,
tables turned.
Yes.
Okay, so she was safe in Australia then.
She was, but that's one thing that I wanted to say. Maybe not many people know about refugees, is that we get placed where we are right now. We don't get 100% choice of where we want to go. So, for example, my sister was placed in Australia because her in-laws were there. My mom, you know, my mom's brother was here, so that's why they, you know, placed us here, thinking this is the best place for us. It could have been Australia that we would have been, you know, resettled in, but there's a purpose for everything. And so that's one thing, is that we don't really get a choice of where we want to go. It's just we get placed where, you know, the UN thinks is best for us.
So how long have you been in the United States then?
7 years.
7 years in the United States. So you left Syria. How long has the war been going on there? I mean, did you see the war before you left? Or had it?
Not entirely. No. It was just starting to happen. And then we were, you know, lucky enough to leave that.
Right. And it's terrible devastation in Syria.
It's very, very bad.
Right. So you came to the United States. What's your impression when you come as a refugee to the United States? How does it feel to be here? What's it like?
You know, it was very different. It was just like there's something missing right now that I don't know what it is. But it was because I never felt safe in Syria or Iraq. I never felt home until I got here, where it was just like, you know, there's nothing coming out next. We're not trying to leave here. This is a place where I get to, you know, spend my life. This is a place I'm welcomed in. And this is my new country, basically.
And you were able to become an American citizen?
Mm-hmm. I am an American citizen. All my family is.
Really?
Yes.
So what was that like?
You know, there's actually, you know, not very exciting, but there's one exciting part of it that inspires me probably until the end of my life, is that, you know, a lot of people, because my mother doesn't speak very well English, both of my parents don't. And so my dad had to study we all passed the exam, but my mother. And everybody was telling my mother, oh, you should get a doctor now because, you know, you really can't study all this, like, you know, the civics and the English part. And you really can't go through the entire interview process because your English is not well enough. And she just came back home and she said, you know what, I'm just going to study for this test. And so for an entire year, I would walk home every day. I would see my dad with a whiteboard. And they're writing words out. And if she would spell it wrong, he would say, like, no, don't spell it wrong. Spell it right. And he was basically her teacher for a year until she actually passed the test a year later. She was a year later than everybody in the family. But
she did.
Just the intuition to get this done. You know, everybody told me I can't do it, but I really can and I will. And she did. And so that's kind of the thing for me, as, you know, my entire life, there are people who pop up in my life and say, you know, maybe this is not for you. Maybe you can't do this. Maybe you can't go through school. You know, it's too hard. It's too difficult. Or, you know, people put me down in many different ways, but I always remember my mother, and I always remember how people put her down and told her that she can't do it, but she did it. And so I just take her as an example. Like, I think nobody can put me down unless I decide to put myself down.
Wow, yeah. That's a powerful witness from your mom to
very,
you.
Very, very powerful.
And so you don't feel like a refugee anymore?
I don't feel as in from, you know, where I'm living and stuff like that, but it's not the government that makes you feel not refugee, but it's more like people around you that make you feel like a refugee. Mm-hmm. You know, it's more like people who stereotype you to be a terrorist or to be a bad person, or, you know, the people who put you down, they just make me feel like this is not my country. You know, like one example is I could say I was once in a chemistry class. And for the people, you know, the first level of chemistry is always like 95% of the class is math. You just do math, 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 math. And so I was in this class and I wasn't doing very well. And I walked up to my teacher halfway through before the drop deadline. And I said, listen, I'm not doing well in your class. And I really, really want to put the effort to do well in your class. What do you think is the problem? And she just looked into my face and she said, your English language is not enough for you to be in my classroom. So that is a problem. And I just, like, stood there with this face. Like, I don't know what to say to you right now. I just don't know. You know, I didn't think that was the problem. I think it was more like me not knowing the system she's going through. But it just didn't happen. And so I told her, I said, but I've already finished all the English levels that require me to get to this level of chemistry. And she said, well, your teachers failed you. And so that was a moment where I actually felt very low, and I felt a refugee. I felt like I can't do this anymore. And I felt like maybe this isn't for me. Maybe college isn't for me because I will never be good in English, you know. And I went back home and I just stood in my mom's face and I said, Mom, like, this happened today. And I was just like crying. And she said, relax. She said, we've been spit on. We've been treated in the worst way. She said, this shouldn't get to you. She said, you're here, you can do it. And she just reminded me of, and after my conversation with my mom, I was like, that's right. We've been through a lot worse than this. I can definitely, you know, move on from this. But to get back to your question, it is the people sometimes who make me feel as a refugee, not the environment.
Well, what do people not get about refugees? What would you like, if you could say, understand this about refugees, what would you say to them?
You know, the main thing that I would like to get to people is that refugees have a dream and they have a future as well. And so for me personally is when I was given the opportunity to be here, I'm not going to abuse this opportunity. I will do my best to give back to the country who took me in as a daughter. You know, I will do my best to give back to the U.S., to be the best person I can in the country to give back. And just to know that people have dreams and they leave their countries because they have dreams and they have intuitions and they can go for it.
And now we have... let's take Syria, another country where the vast majority of people are Muslim. Mm-hmm. And I think that many Americans might say, well, they'd be happy to take the Christian refugees, mm-hmm. but they'd rather not take the Muslim refugees.
There are good and bad people in every population, so I can't really, I have very, very diverse, you know, many, many diverse types of friends, and I have some Muslim friends here, and they're amazing, you know. I have some Christian friends that are very, very bad. And so you can't really judge people by their background. It's kind of like a hit or miss, you know. You get a population of people, you think they're Christians and you think they're going to be good and they don't end up being that. And so there's not a way of detecting that. But I also think that we can't just shut the doors and be like, we can't take anybody because there are a lot of people who are going through this that don't deserve to go through this.
Mm-hmm. Is your sense that among the people who have come out of Iraq and Syria, Christians primarily, do you have a sense that they're never going back? Or are there people like, well, when it's peaceful again, I'll go back? Or, I mean, I know you're an American citizen now, mm-hmm. but is there a sense that, no, it's too hard to live in those countries as a Christian? People don't want to go back there.
You know, I've heard a couple of my friends say, when it's peaceful and when it's all better, I'm going to go back because they never felt home here. But I personally don't think that way. But there are a lot of people who want to go back. I know it's going to be hard for them to go back and live in there. And that's probably, you know, easier said than done. But some people do want to go back. Because, again, I mean, these countries, we're talking about the countries that Christ have lived in. You know, we have a lot of churches. We have a lot of holy places. And, you know, as of my mom, she wants to live in, you know, Palestine. And she doesn't want to leave there because that's where Christ was.
Yeah.
And so... for some people, it's very emotional. That's why for Lebanon and for, you know, Palestine, it's hard for them to leave because, you know, this is where their home is.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's the place where the prophets walked. It's the place mm-hmm. where Abraham,
yep.
you know, and the Apostle Thomas came to what's now Iraq. And you grow up being aware of that.
Yes.
Yep. And it's hard to... Well, I don't know. We no apostles that we know of ever came to San Diego. We don't have that kind of, you know. It's very...
Yeah.
Well, we had Father Sarah, but he wasn't one of the original 12. So the what do you know then of the, say, Christians in Iraq and Syria now? Would they get out if they could?
Oh, yeah.
Everybody?
Everybody.
Every single one of them would get out if they
mm-hmm.
could. Because of ISIS, because of just the general, it's gotten too violent there or what?
Yeah, I mean, everything is hard. We're talking medical. We're talking no water, no shelter, no nothing. So yeah. You're basically leaving this, you know, the worst case scenario in a tent or whatever. And you have a baby on your hand, or you have a kids, or you have a wife, and you have a mother, a disabled mother, and stuff like that. And so it's very hard to stay there with, you know, very minimal basic needs and all of that.
Right. Are there priests that you know who go back and forth, that they may come over here and then go back?
Actually, I'm not sure about some details, but there were a couple of priests from here that were, you know, asked to go back. And I don't know about the specific details, but, you know, it was very hard to make that decision to go back.
Mm-hmm. And what would you say to Catholics, or maybe Christians in general, but particularly to your brother and sister Catholics in America, about practicing the faith here? I mean, given what you've been there, what would you say about practicing the faith here?
That's kind of like the main thing, is that when Catholics they come here, you know, they know the value of being Catholic. And for me personally, you know, when I got here, I was 16, I started, you know, to goof off a little bit and not go to church and stuff like that. But then once I realized what people have to go through over there to go to church every Sunday, I started just embracing my faith and just trying to get the best out of it. Because, you know, just go to church every Sunday knowing that there are people in the Middle East right now going to the same through the same situation, going to church every Sunday. But the difference between here and there, that over there, somebody could walk in and bomb the entire place, yet they're still choosing to go over there and be with God, be fully with God, because that's the only thing they care about when they go to church, is that I'm with God. Nothing else matters to me right now. And so that's what I want for people to realize here, is that when we go to church, we're very blessed. We're very blessed to be able to go to church and just be with God. We're very blessed to be able to wear a cross here and not have somebody walk up to you and just like take it off from you because, you know, you're wearing a cross.
Would that happen in Syria?
Oh, yeah.
So if you, like, you're wearing a gold cross right now, if you wore that walking down the street in Aleppo, someone...
Aleppo, maybe not very much, but more of like Iraq.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just, And so who helped you as a refugee? Like, do you look back now and go, I wish people would... you know, support this group or support that group, because they're the ones that really helped us?
I mean, I'm a little biased towards the UN, the UNHCR, because it was the agency that got me out of, you know, my home country. And so they take, you know, donations and stuff like that.
That's the High Commission for Refugees, the UN High Commission for Refugees.
The UNHCR.
Okay, so give me an example. What do they do for you?
So I remember when I was, actually this is just coming to me right now, when we were in Aleppo, we had to travel for 5 hours to go to Damascus, so the main city. And when we got there, they were helping out by giving like blankets, they were giving out, you know, like rice and food. And so that's additional to them helping us get here.
I see.
And so they give you like these basic needs that you know, like... basic like foods and water and stuff like that. But I remember I'm a horrible drawer and I don't like to draw anything. But I remember like sitting down on the outside when we were waiting for our interview, and I was like drawing their label, the UNHCR label, which was like two hands sheltering like a person. And I don't know what happened to it, but I was just sitting down and I was drawing it. And it was just because this, you know, person of me that's... I want to show you that I'm thankful right now. And I don't like to draw, but I'm going to draw this because I have, you know, emotional towards this agency. And so it was just this relief that came when we went over there. And so they really do help a lot of people over there.
And anybody else?
There's another agency that I follow on Facebook. They're called the Samaritan's Purse, and they do a lot of you know, minister work on set. So if you want to like become a ministry, you know, person, go over there, you can minister there and actually be on set. They help with like medical, water, like basically like crisis help. Like the recent Syrian crisis that happened, they were there and they were helping and they were getting people off the boats and stuff like that. They do a lot of basic needs like food, water, shelter, medical, just international crisis help.
And so now you're how far from finishing college?
So I have one more year up in LA, and then hopefully I'll be coming down to start the doctorate program next year around this time.
Uh-huh. Study to be a physician.
Yep. And a physical therapist.
Oh, physical therapist.
Yeah.
And who do you want to help? Like, what's...
So the main so this is also goes back to when I came here. So when I first came here, I had like an allergy condition, and they couldn't figure out what was going on with me, and they sent me to Rady Children's, and when I got dropped off, I looked up and I saw this big, huge building, and I said, "Oh my gosh, I've never seen anything like this." And when we walked in, there were like little toys everywhere, and I said, "Oh my gosh, can I just stay here? Can I live here? Like, is this, like, what is this?" And so I just felt again this relief in this hospital, and just the physicians were really nice to me and all of that. And so I grew up knowing that whatever I want to do in life, it's going to be in Rady Children's. And
really?
So I want to be a physical therapist, and I want to come back to do work with Rady Children's for that purpose. And I also want to do, you know, some outside work with helping some, you know, refugees that can't afford medical help, that don't get the medical help they need, as in, you know, physical.
Right.
So I want to do a lot of that. And I also want to, but the Rady Children's is very emotional to me, and I really want to be able to do work with them.
So you're thriving, having been a refugee for a good part of your life. You're thriving now, and you're ready to do the things that where you can serve others and live apparently at the children's hospital. I don't know.
If I can, maybe I'll do that.
Do you see, is that common in the refugee community? Do you see people who, for whom it's too much and they're not thriving? Is more help needed? What kind of help would it be if it is needed?
You know, it's very hard when you first get here. The language is a big part of it. So I came here, you know, when I was 16, and I didn't speak any English. I was in high school, trying to go through high school, but I didn't have any of the language. And so the language part of it is very, very difficult. The other parts are such as like financial parts. So we have a lot of like refugees who come here. They're just, you know, an elderly couple that don't have anybody to help them.
Yeah.
And so they end up being in this country that they don't know how to figure it out. And they don't know. And, you know, by the grace of God, they get help from people either, you know, from citizens here or other Chaldeans or other people around here. And thankfully, you know, San Diego, like you said, you know, in Michigan and here, there's a lot of resettlement of the, you know, the Middle Eastern community. And so we can help each other around. And we're very thankful for that. But there are a lot of ways, like, you know, other people can help that would really be, you know, nice to have to receive.
And what are those ways? Like, what would you like to, like, if you said to people, here's what you can do, like, practically, would it all be financial help? What would it be?
No, not a lot of it. You know, like we said about, like, the two agencies that can help, but that's financially. But there are other things that maybe you could do. Like, you know, if you could just, you know, you're a teacher, you could volunteer a few hours just teach the language to some of the refugees, you know, that it would be greatly appreciated to just help them, you know, fill out these different forms, like medical forms that they need to fill out that they don't know how to do it, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of, you know, little things that can help. Also stuff like, you know, like for me, as in going to school, a lot of things is needed, like scholarships. So if you, you know, work at a college or something like that, it could be very helpful to offer scholarships to refugees who actually, like, need it and don't have jobs and want to do something with their future.
Yeah.
You know, scholarships can be really helpful for college students because, in recent stats show that less than 1% students make it to university because they can, you know, they have a way with the financial stuff. But if they don't have a way with that, they just can't continue on. And, you know, there are other ways, maybe like employer refugee, if you're an employer and you get somebody and you have a good feeling about this person and they're a refugee, you know, give them a chance because they will thrive. And one last thing is, of course, you know, a prayer can go a long way, you know, a prayer for the people over there that can be very, very, you know, a prayer is more powerful than anything you could do.
Now, how do you just your own, how do you feel when you see it since you left? It has become just waves of refugees. It's, mm-hmm. I mean, there were people coming when you were coming, mm-hmm. but in the subsequent years, it became a flood of refugees. Does that bring up feelings for you, or How do you feel about that?
What do you mean?
Like when you see this flood of refugees coming, how do you respond emotionally to their situation?
I mean, it makes me happy to see that a lot of people are being saved, but it also, you know, it pushes me more to do more towards the people over there, because that's kind of like the number one goal, is to give them the better life. And then depending on what they choose with their life, you know, to do here, it will be, you know, hopefully it'll be something beneficial in a way or another. But it makes me feel good in a way to see all these refugees coming here, because I know if they don't abuse this opportunity of giving a new country, then they will be given the better life.
Mm-hmm. And so now you talked about your struggle speaking English, but your original language is Arabic.
Mm-hmm.
And so do you, when you see like at church or something, new people come, do you say anything? Like someone who just, they came over from Iraq just now. Mm-hmm. Do you, and maybe they don't speak English. Maybe they don't, mm-hmm. like, do you have words of encouragement for them, or is there that kind of?
I mean, I've worked with children, and they actually, you know, I really can't do much other than be an example for them.
Uh-huh.
You know, for a lot of these children that I worked with look up to me, and I'm not in a position where to look up to, but for them to be able, you know, like, I want to be like Miss Lal one day, just, you know, be able to speak and go to college here. And so that for me is a big thing. But as in, you know, adults, it's very helpful. Like, you could just like, oh, you can, you know, you can go online and look up videos of English. You know, if you need me to fill out an application for you, like, I'll come by if you need me. Like, this is my phone number, this is my email, whatever. You know, just the basic help. But like I said, you know, we're a community here, so we help each other a lot.
So you said, for in addition to all the other ways you said people can help, people can teach, people can help people fill out forms, people can pray. But for yourself, in your experience, you would be pleased if people would financially support Samaritan's Purse and the UN High Commission for mm-hmm. Refugees.
Yep.
Dalal Salid, thank you very much. I really enjoyed spending time with you.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great. And it's wonderful to, you know, I think in many ways we probably hear about refugees, but it's great to be able to talk with you directly about your experience so that we can get to know what the real experience is like.
Thank you so much. I appreciate
it. And congratulations on your studies.
Thank
Good luck.
Thank you.
Persevere.
Yep.
Your mother did.
Yes,
there's no reason
did.
For you to give up, Dalal.
I will never give up.
Oh, if people want to get in touch with you, I think what we'll do is we'll just contact us at radio@catholic.com if you want to get in touch with Dalal for any reason. radio@catholic.com. We'll make sure that she gets that message. Again, thank you very much, Dalal Saeed. And I am Cy Kellett, your host. This is Catholic Answers Focus. Thanks so much for joining us. We do it every week. We hope we'll see you again next time on Catholic Answers Focus.